The last case in our calendar is 001829, State of Ohio, ex-rel Michael Weyrung versus the Honorable Patrick Nickellacker. Mr. Maiman.
Yes, Your Honor.
May it please the court, my name is Earl Maiman, and along with Jim Perry, I have the honor of representing Michael Weyrung in these proceedings. If I may, I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Watch your time here.
Your Honors, in 1996, the General Assembly decided to shift the focus of Ohio's system of juvenile justice. That shift was away from the purely rehabilitation strategy characterized by parens patriae and toward a get-tough approach of punishment and deterrence. It was entirely within the prerogative of the General Assembly to legislate that shift. No problem there. However, it is absolutely not within the prerogative and absolutely not within the authority of a common pleas judge to reach back in time, Your Honors, and to apply this 1996 statute so as to change the legal consequences for events that occurred decades before the statute was enacted.
And
go ahead.
You say that, counsel, that the way you responded was to file a writ of prohibition to
yes.
seek to prevent the trial judge from exercising jurisdiction. And to me, even though the other is quite interesting, to me that's really the issue that this court is asked to decide, whether or not a writ, in this case an extraordinary writ of prohibition, fits the requirements to forestall the proceedings in the common pleas court. You argue that the court patently and unambiguously lacks jurisdiction.
Exactly.
And given that, I know the standards of this court have varied, but given that standard and given the express statutory, you know, the statute you just mentioned that offers the trial court a basis to decide it has jurisdiction, how can you say that it's patent and unambiguous that the court lacks it? And I understand your argument about it's old, you know, it's an old crime and it's a new statute, but nevertheless the statute is it patent that the court has no jurisdiction?
It's absolutely patent, Your Honor, when you have the Constitution of the United States saying that this may not be done, and when you have the Constitution of Ohio saying this may not be done, that you cannot apply a law retroactively so as to change the legal consequences for events which occurred before. This would be, Your Honor, just like if we had people suing the state of Ohio and common pleas courts all over the place, and the common pleas courts going ahead and trying these cases, and the state having to wait until it got to a court of appeals to have the court of appeals say, oh no, that case has got to go to the court of claims. It is just as patent here, but here it's based upon constitutional rights. And this is not some constitutional right that has been read in, you know, to the Constitution between the lines. I mean, it is in black and white in the United States Constitution.
But isn't the problem with that argument that you have to get to the merit case to decide or to argue that the trial court has no jurisdiction, or that this is not an appropriate remedy, or is not an appropriate remedy? Isn't that you could argue that in every case where there's a merit issue and a writ of prohibition is filed, saying, well, clearly the trial court doesn't have the authority to decide this case because here it's cited a bunch of cases. But that's, we decide those cases on appeal all the time.
I understand that, Your Honor, but that is why the standard
here the trial court could county police court could hear the case against the objection, of course, of the defendant, and convicts the defendant, and there's an appeal, is there not? And then that merit issue is raised on appeal.
But it doesn't go to the merits of the crime and who committed the crime and all the rest.
Well, it goes to the legal issue, sure. Mm-hmm.
Shouldn't you first be addressing whether this is an ex post facto law, the fact that this penalty that he has a possibility of receiving in the common police court, general division, is greater than what he would receive in the juvenile court? Isn't really that the heart of it?
It's profoundly greater, that's right. And that is why, that goes, of course, that demonstrates how substantive this 1996 law is. Your Honor.
I'm interested in the old law.
Yes, sir.
If this case were prosecuted under the old law, could this defendant, proper to use the word defendant, because if we're operating under the old law, he's not a defendant at that point. Could the probate or the juvenile judge have a discretion? Is there a discretionary bind over under the old law? In other words, could he end up in the same place?
Yeah, under the 1963 law, of course, the focal point was rehabilitation, but the court in 1963, the juvenile court did have the discretion to bind over a child accused of an act of delinquency.
Discretionary with a set of standards,
right.
Well-developed case law that fleshed out those standards.
Right. There would have to be probable cause and then a social evaluation to determine rehabilitation potential.
If he had been brought before the juvenile judge and charged with delinquency, the case could ultimately have been, at the discretion of the juvenile judge, transferred to the common police judge, and then be in the place he is today, with the same range of sentencing options or implications in terms of punishment
that is
faces today.
That is correct, Your Honor, and that bindover proceeding is what is part of what has been divested through the retroactive application of this statute.
But the bindover proceeding's purpose was to determine if this child was subject to rehabilitation, and how do you possibly make that determination 30 years later? How will this trial judge in juvenile court make that determination now?
Well, that's a fair question, Your Honor, but that is a problem, an issue, if you will, that existed from the dawn of civilization up until the passage of this act in 1996, and it's rather clear that the act was designed to address that issue under certain circumstances on a going-forward basis.
Has this defendant been in any legal trouble since?
Your Honor, he has lived an exemplary life. He's a business person. He's got children and grandchildren. And
how could the prosecutor then ever succeed in an argument that he somehow needs to stay in the juvenile system until he's 21? I mean, what are you going to do? Put him in a juvenile detention facility at age 50?
No, I think that the circumstances are going to differ for each defendant who comes before the juvenile court for crimes committed before 1996. But the juvenile court cannot put him in a chronological adult in a juvenile detention center, but the juvenile court does have a broad range of other options and has the discretion under the statute to make other kinds of remedies. And in 1963, they were very, very, very creative, if you will, in the kinds of remedies that they would employ with juveniles, doing things like community service and all sorts of other things. And that's
juvenile court, in a best case scenario for you, says, all right, you've lived an exemplary life for 30 years, probable cause you committed this murder, but you've rehabilitated yourself, so go forth and spend 3 years in adult prison, and that would have put you at 21 and you're gone.
No, he would first have to find him guilty, or he would first have to find him a delinquent. He would first have to find that Mr. Wyrung had in fact have committed the crime, which he didn't.
Okay, let's assume that he finds that he committed the crime.
Okay, and then...
What's the range of penalties?
The range of penalties is limited, I think, only by the juvenile court's own imagination. He has the opportunity to enforce a variety of different kinds of things.
But not beyond what would have been the equivalent of age 21, which would have been, what, 6 more years?
No, well,
18,
that would have been, he was 15 at the time of the event, and so it would have been 6 more years.
Counselor?
Yes.
When you seek a writ of prohibition, is that a civil case in nature as opposed to a criminal?
A writ of prohibition? Yes, Your Honor.
Is your argument that 2151-23I is unconstitutional based on ex post facto?
No. The statute as written on a going forward basis, we are not attacking its constitutionality. What we're saying is that it cannot be applied to crimes or offenses which were committed before the date of its enactment.
Why? Because that's not constitutional.
Because that itself is not constitutional,
so
yes.
So you really are attacking it, in this case, on the constitutionality.
Oh, yeah. The attack is a constitutional attack, Your Honor, but it's not directed at the statute. It's directed at the court's application of the statute to an event that occurred back in 1963.
Did you serve the Attorney General?
Did I serve the Attorney General? No, Your Honor, I did not.
Does the statute require, if you're questioning the constitutionality of the statute, that the Attorney General must be served?
I'm not.
Give jurisdiction?
I'm not questioning the constitutionality of the statute,
well,
Your Honor.
You told me you were.
No.
That.
No, Your Honor. What I'm questioning is the common pleas judge's application of that statute to events that occurred in 1963. I am not questioning the constitutionality of the statute itself. As far as I'm concerned, as we sit here now, it can be applied on a going forward basis to anyone, you know, who commits an offense.
Anybody but your client.
Anybody who commits an offense after 1996, Your Honor. My client is alleged to have committed an offense in 1963. The federal constitution and the state constitution say you can't. You have got to look at the law as it existed at the time of the offense. That's what Weaver versus Graham says. That's what Carmel says. That's what this court has said before as well. You've got to look and take a snapshot at the law, of the law on the day of the offense.
So you're not asking us to throw out the statute as unconstitutional, but just as applied?
As applied, yes, Your Honor. Absolutely, in this instance.
That's still a constitutional argument?
I beg your pardon?
That's still a constitutional argument?
I believe so. I mean, It really matters not to me what name we put on it. The fact is it's an unconstitutional application of the statute. And that is what the problem is here.
Doesn't the statute, though, say that if the person is not apprehended until after the person attains 21 years of age, the juvenile court does not have jurisdiction to hear or determine any portion of the case? So doesn't the statute require the result that for which you argue?
I didn't hear the part of the statute that you read.
Well, maybe I'm not understanding, but it says for that act until after the person, and if a person is not taken into custody or apprehended for that act until after this act he committed before 18, and not taken into custody or apprehended for that act until after the person attains 21 years of age, which I think is
what's happened here.
Person here. The juvenile court does not have jurisdiction to hear or determine any portion of the case charging the person with committing that act.
That means
the common pleas court has jurisdiction, I guess.
That's the 1996 statute, Your Honor, that's being read. And that's the statute that's being retroactively applied to the 1963 event.
Right.
Which changes the law completely, because under 2151-35 in 1963, the juvenile court continued to have jurisdiction for any act that was committed before the accused was age 18, even after the age of 18.
Your sole basis is really that you don't want this particular statute applied retroactively. Actively, you're not really questioning the constitutionality of it, only insofar as
that's right. That's right. That's right. We are not attacking the statute. Like I say, the General Assembly can institute this law on a going-forward basis for any offense that occurs after 1996. But you can't take this law and go back to 1963 and say, well, okay, in 1963, we're going to take that alleged offense and apply this statute to it. That is absolutely prohibited, and there's just no two ways about it. And it's patent, which is another way of saying it's patent and unambiguous, that it is prohibited. Are there any other questions that I can answer for the court at this point in time?
Except one thing, that the test is not whether it's patent and unambiguous that it can't be applied. It's that that's the test for whether or not the court can exercise jurisdiction.
Right. That is correct, Your Honor. It's patent and unambiguous, Your Honor, that the court can't exercise jurisdiction because as a matter of patent constitutional law, he cannot take a 1996 statute and apply it to an offense that occurred in 1963.
The trial court determines its own jurisdiction. Couldn't the trial court just as easily find that it's ex post facto, therefore not applicable, and then there's a way of an appeal for that? Doesn't that defeat prohibition?
If the trial court had found that it was ex post facto, the case would have gone back to the juvenile court. He would have transferred it back, and that's where the case would have commenced. And then perhaps the state would have sought a writ of mandamus, and we would have been here anyway.
The one of the cases you cite is the Adams
versus Gus Weiler.
Right.
Yes.
In that case, I know you know that it speaks about, it says it should be clearly understood that where language seemingly to the contrary appears in our prior decisions, the inferior court that here had at least basic statutory jurisdiction to proceed in the case. Can that be said of this case?
Absolutely not. Absolutely
and I know the reason you say the statute says it, but one must go beyond the statute to say the court doesn't have jurisdiction. Obviously, the basic statute seems to accord the trial court the jurisdiction to proceed.
No, well, the basic statute doesn't say it should be retroactively applied. It doesn't even do that, Your Honor. I mean, it would be wrong for the statute to say that, but it doesn't even say retroactively apply this statute.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Maven.
Thank you.
Mr. Stitch.
Thank you, Your Honor. The court has focused in large measure on some of the issues that I think are important to address this morning. And the key issue is whether or not what we were really talking about here is the jurisdiction of the court or the effort of Mr. Waring to attack the statutes under which the court has exercised jurisdiction or attack in some other fashion what he is claiming are ex post facto laws. In reality, if we look at the jurisdictional issue, it is patent and unambiguous that Judge Dinkelocker had jurisdiction as a result of the statute. The juvenile.
How would that be?
For the very language that Judge Moyer read from before in 2151.23i.
Was that the law in 1963?
It was not, Your Honor.
Okay. So how would that not be the law simply going forward? That going forward, an act committed after the enactment of this statute, undiscovered until you're 21, you're in common pleas court.
Well, Your Honor, I think that focuses directly upon the issue and the flaw in the analysis. The statutes of the state of Ohio, as the General Assembly has decreed, are to be applied prospectively. And this statute was, which is a jurisdictional statute relating to a court, which is a creature of the General Assembly, whose jurisdiction is based upon what the General Assembly has said, no longer has jurisdiction over this type of case, because looking prospectively at the time the charges were filed against this 53-year-old individual, the juvenile court no longer had jurisdiction.
Counsel, if you're right in your analysis that this is not the retroactive application of, and that, first of all, that's the whole key, isn't it? Because the Court of Appeals And the majority opinion gives us almost no guidance. It just says absent patent on ambiguous lack of jurisdiction. A court has subject matter jurisdiction. They don't even discuss whether or not this is a retroactively applied statute. Judge Doan does, but they don't.
That's correct, Your Honor, and I think that if the court would like to look at an analysis from an appellate court that does address that, it could look at State v. Wall, which is the case that was decided out of Butler County that addressed this very same issue with a slight twist, and it's a twist that actually has some significance to the case if we go back to 63.
Where I was going to go with a hypothetical is if you're right in your analysis, let's assume some juvenile commits a crime that just has a community totally upset, but it's not a automatic bind over, or the jurisdiction is not automatically in the common pleas court. Could not the prosecutor decide, instead of serving charges, to go see his legislator, get the law changed, and then file the charges?
Well, Your Honor, we're not dealing with the same situation in this instance, but what has happened is that the legislature has decided to fix the jurisdiction of the juvenile court, which has a purpose and an intention to rehabilitate juveniles, and decided that as a matter of policy, there is no legitimate reason to say that it should have jurisdiction over people who are past the age of majority. Now, we don't have an effort in this instance to take a specific individual and attempt to apply new or harsher consequences to that specific individual.
Okay, but wouldn't the general rule, you just said the legislature, unless there's something to the contrary, enacts things prospective in nature only. And wouldn't the general rule be then that for acts committed prior to the enactment of the legislation, the old law would apply and not the new law?
Well, the old law is applying on the substance of the acts. What we're talking about here, however, is the jurisdiction of the court that must administer the law that is applicable to 1963.
Now, I assume also that you have argued successfully to this point that you have an adequate remedy at law. Just go ahead and submit to the jurisdiction of the common pleas court, get yourself convicted and sentenced, and then appeal, arguing that this case should have started out in the juvenile court. And if you're successful, go back to the juvenile court, already convicted of murder, and try to persuade the juvenile judge that you ought not be bound over to the common pleas court.
Well, Your Honor, I think that the problem with that analysis...
I mean, isn't that the process that you're recommending to this defense?
Well, that certainly is the process that this court has endorsed in every instance in which there is jurisdiction in the court, notwithstanding the fact that there has been a challenge, whether constitutional or otherwise, to the manner in which the court is proceeding. The issue of the jurisdiction, whether it lies in the juvenile court or the common pleas court, is in a sense a Trojan horse, an effort by the petitioner to get this court to look at the underlying law that is going to be applied to his particular case. The real gist of what he is saying is, not despite the fact that I am 53 years old and despite the fact that I have long passed the age of being a juvenile, want the benefit of what I consider to be the more benevolent procedures that are available to me in a juvenile court. If this court were to decide that he has that entitlement because his acts were committed in 1963 at a time when he was a minor, and if he is found guilty of that, then the question would be what procedures apply to the commission of an act at the time one is a minor. The fact that the juvenile court at one point had jurisdiction, and the juvenile court, which is a creature of statute and a creature of the General Assembly, has now been divested of that jurisdiction, does not mean that no court has jurisdiction over the acts that were committed in 1963. It means, however, that whatever court now has jurisdiction must view the case and administer the case in such a way that the law, substantive law as it applied in 1963, is applied in this instance. If we look at the substantive law as it applied in 1963, those laws are being applied in this case.
Well, as the substantive law existed in 1963, until such time as the juvenile court determined that this person should be bound over, he would be deemed to be, or alleged to be, a delinquent offender.
If
if the court did not make a determination to bind over, the range of penalties would be significantly less than the range of penalties that are going to be available to him in county police court. And that's a threshold determination that was available to him in 1963.
Well, the difference, however, Your Honor, is that you're looking at it from the standpoint of what the justice system would have done had Mr. Waring been arrested and charged with the crime in 1963. What we're faced with
I think I'm trying to look at it in terms of what were the range of penalty options. And you have, by bringing this in common pleas court, taken a portion of the penalty options off the table without any judicial determination that they should be off the table. If you file this in juvenile court, that, as I understand it, the judge could say, I think this is a case that should be bound over, and then those juvenile penalty options are off the table, but that's only after a judicial determination.
Well, what we're dealing with here, however, Your Honor, is a situation in which the jurisdiction over the individual and over the offense has been taken away by the legislature, as it is entitled to do, from the juvenile court and vested in the Court of Common Pleas. The case could not have been filed in juvenile court. Now the court is addressing the question of whether or not...
Can they retroactively move jurisdiction?
They're not doing so retroactively.
They're not.
Because they're doing it only as to cases that would be filed after the effective date, which is what we are faced with here. What you're addressing, Justice Pfeiffer, is the question of what ultimately the substantive law would be and what penalties should apply should Mr. Waring be found guilty. Now, that is a completely separate question from whether or not the Common Pleas Court has jurisdiction over the administration of this case. It is quite clear from the statute that the court has jurisdiction over the administration of this case. Now the court, if it was to find that there is some sort of substantive right in the procedures that the juvenile court and the penalties that were available to the juvenile court, that there was a substantive right which had vested in the petitioner, then the question would be on appeal, as it properly should be, was he accorded, was he sentenced, was he treated under the correct substantive law, or should the Common Pleas Court, if you were to so find, have been obligated to go back and borrow from the juvenile law as it applied at that time? Because remember that the Court of Common Pleas is a court of general jurisdiction. The juvenile court is simply a creature of statute.
Mr. Waring was not charged, not even charged until after he was 21, correct?
Correct.
Would your analysis be different if he had been charged at age 15 and had fled the state and not been apprehended for 30 years?
Your Honor, the analysis in that instance would be different under the 1996 law, because if he had been apprehended, then jurisdiction would still attach under the language of the statute.
How would you argue, assuming that he has, in fact, lived an exemplary life since then, how would you go back if we held in favor of the defendant, and how would you go back and argue that he could not be rehabbed and should be sent to adult court?
Well, Your Honor, I think that the question that we face in a juvenile court with a juvenile is quite different from the question that we face in a juvenile court if we're going to, or any other court, when we look at an adult. And the question at that point is whether or not the juvenile court has anything to offer to a 53-year-old man. The purpose of the bindover procedure is, among other things, to determine whether or not the juvenile court system can do anything for that person. And at this stage, there's no question that nothing could be done for Mr. Waring at his age and in his status. And so the question is, simply at that stage, what law applies to the commission of a 1963 offense? And even if we go back to 1963, and if Mr. Waring's position is that he gets the benefit of the law as it was in 1963, we have to look at how the law in 1963 would have treated a 53-year-old who was charged with an offense that was committed at the time that that person was a juvenile. And if we look at the statute as it existed in 1963 for the juvenile court, it stated that the juvenile court had exclusive jurisdiction over cases in which the child is alleged to be a delinquent. Now, there is a provision in one of the procedural sections, which is cited in the reply, that allows the court to have jurisdiction over an individual who has become an adult, but it does not confer exclusive jurisdiction. And there is nothing in the jurisdictional statute that confers exclusive jurisdiction or any other jurisdiction over one who is not charged until that person is an adult. And it is...
Counselor, just for purposes of argument, I'd like you to accept that I or we have made up our mind on the ex post facto question, because we have had to read the merits stuff, and your major argument is on prohibition and adequate remedy at law, and I understand that. But supposing we've made up our mind that when we see this in another case that we have here, and or this one, that we're going to end up saying ex post facto, clearly shouldn't have been applied, it's substantive, shouldn't have been retrospective. And yet we're wrestling with the prohibition issue that you are arguing, and I think well, and that the Court of Appeals talked about. What should we do under those circumstances if we already know what the ultimate result might be? Put him through the whole trial?
Well, Your Honor, I think that if you were to decide that he should be subjected to the procedures that were available to the juvenile court, and we're faced with a statute that now no longer gives a juvenile court jurisdiction over the person, because that is, the juvenile court's jurisdiction attaches to the person, and any offenses then would follow with the person. The question would be whether or not you should instruct Judge Dinkelocker to apply the law as it existed in 1963, not only to the offense of murder, but to the juvenile statutes that apply to an individual who commits that offense at the time prior to the age of majority. That being the case, it would be a question of whether or not Judge Dinkelocker should go through and apply the juvenile law as it existed at that time, which would include, among other things, the question of bindover. So the question of which court, I mean...
Do you ever get to that merit issue? Have you gotten to that merit issue yet?
We don't get to that issue in this case. We need not get to that issue in this case, but obviously I think that it's an issue that everybody will be quite interested in as the case proceeds. But if we look at simply the question that is before the court today, is there or is there not jurisdiction? There is patent and unambiguous jurisdiction as a result of Revised Code Chapter 2151. And it is equally clear that the constitutional issues can be raised by way of appeal. And if we look at whether we look at the laws that existed in 1963, at a time when the Court of Common Pleas had concurrent jurisdiction with the juvenile court, as this court has noted, was changed in 69 and then changed back in 1996, or we look at the law today when we prospectively apply the jurisdiction, there is no reason there should be a violation of any constitutional rights by virtue of one court rather than another court exercising jurisdiction over the case.
My example was, I've already made up my mind on that issue. Should we put him through the trial?
Well, Your Honor, I think that the issue in this case goes back, as with every prohibition issue, whether the court has made its mind up on the other underlying merits or not, which is that it must address those issues.
You win.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Stitch. Mr. Maiman, you have used your time. Would you may take 30 seconds?
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll say one thing then with the 30 seconds I have, and that is this. Since Adams v. Gusweiler in 1972, this court has recognized that there is inherent injustice in forcing a defendant to sit through a trial, and in this instance, a dramatically public trial, a celebrated trial, in front of a judge that does not have jurisdiction to hear the case, and where it is absolutely patent and unambiguous that that judge is applying a law unconstitutionally so that he may sit and hear that case and put the defendant through that gross injustice.
But, Counselor, we do that in double jeopardy cases where we have reversed the case and it goes back. They plead double jeopardy. Double jeopardy motion for dismissal denied. Not final and not appealable.
But the law, Your Honor, the law with respect to jurisdiction, because jurisdiction is so important, since 1972 in Adams' case, this court has held time and again that you don't allow and force someone to sit through a trial where the court patently lacks jurisdiction, as is the case in this instance.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. The marshal will please adjourn court.
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio now stands adjourned.
Thank you.